The first year of widowhood, I think, is really hard.
I often think about it as waking up in a world that you've never been to before, where you don't speak the language, you don't know the rules, the culture is different, and it's dark.
Have you ever been told that you go overboard? Or maybe you have a friend, a partner, or a crazy aunt who overdoes it at the holidays. Someone who is overly ambitious, overly excited, and gets overwhelmed because she tends to overdo everything. Well, welcome to my world. I'm Nancy Scanlon-Coppler, and this is Woman Overboard, a show about women, leaders, mothers, and entrepreneurs who are dedicated to making a difference. My guests would not be where they are today without being the overachievers that they are. Women who, I believe, put a positive spin on the words woman overboard. So we are following up on our interview about widowhood, since I went totally overboard when I lost my husband, Ted, in April of 2021. And today we are talking with Patty Krogan and Peggy Cohen-Voss, who are with the National Council of Jewish Women in St. Louis and the Wife Widow Woman Program. Patty Krogan is a licensed clinical social worker, and she has expertise in individual group psychotherapy. She shares her understanding of the human experience not only with her clients, but as a leader in the Jewish community. She facilitated grief support groups for the cancer support community before offering her skills in 2018 to NCJW to lead groups for the Wife Widow Woman Program. Peggy Cohen-Voss, Ph.D., retired from a university career as a teacher, researcher, and academic leader. For 34 years, her work in educational psychology at the University of Missouri at St. Louis focused on understanding and improving teaching and learning in elementary, secondary, and higher education classrooms. Peggy was a 2016 participant in the Wife, Widow, Woman program. She began co-facilitating groups with Patty Krogan in 2018 and joined the NCJW board in 2021. Patty and Peggy, welcome to Woman Overboard.
Thank you.
And I think the three of us are widows, so we all share that understanding. So I'm looking forward to our talk. I recently interviewed Carolyn Moore, who's a widow's national widow's advocate and founder of the Modern Widows Club. And I told her how great the comfort was of the Wife Widow program, which is part of the NCJW. But as we discussed the program and how wonderful it's been for me, I'd love you to share a little bit of history of the National Council of Jewish Women in St. Louis and how WWW came to be.
I would be glad to do that. The National Council of Jewish Women in St. Louis created this program in 1976. It was at the initiation of a therapist and a widow. What stands out for me when I think about the history is that this program is unique to the National Council of Jewish Women in St. Louis. The estimate is that about 1,000 women have benefited from it. NCJW's mission is to be a catalyst to improve the lives of women, children, and families. And this program fits beautifully into that mission. To join the Wife, Widow, Woman program, one need not be a member of NCJW. The program is open to anyone of any religion, any denomination, any race. So folks listening to this program, you know, might be interested in hearing that you can find a lot of information on the NCJW website, and the person to contact at the office is the Director of Community Impact, whose name is Renee Siegelhurst. Her phone number is 314-993-5181.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I wouldn't have known how to contact the group, but I have a very dear friend, and I will mention her name, Martha Aronson, who was a salvation for me. She had talked about my reaching out to join Wife, Widow, Woman and gave me some background about her mother, who it was suggested that she join, and she said, oh, I don't think I need that group, but maybe I could help someone else in the group. And then she got in the group and ended up making lifelong friends and finding actual solace herself from the women that
that supported her. And Peggy, if you could share with us, since you were a member in 2016 after you lost your husband, how did it help you with your own grief journey?
Well, let me tell that story just a bit.
Okay.
I saw a little announcement in the community newspaper, The Jewish Light, that a group was forming for the Wife, Widow, Woman program. Just a small little blurb. And to call NCJW. So I called NCJW, left my name and number. My husband passed away in November 2015. And so in February, I was making this phone call. And I got a call back from the woman who was coordinating the program. And after the course of our conversation, I had probably gone through a box of Kleenex.
At
which point she said, Peggy, it's a little bit early for you to participate in this program. So the idea is to get some distance because at 2-3 months, there's still a lot of
shock,
business and shock and things to do that not only keep one occupied, but just keep on bringing up memories that are still pretty...
A lot.
So I asked if she offered to put me on the list and call, and can we call you in 3 months? And that's when I said yes and joined a group of women. I think there were 12 of us, and what I'd like you to hear is that we ranged from 40-something to 90-something.
Wow. That's a range.
The group was very diverse, and I think that is one of the hallmarks of the program, that anyone is welcome. And I remember asking, but will I be the youngest? I was 62. And the answer to that was cagey. You'll be younger, but I wasn't given specifics, which would make sense for confidentiality reasons. But I think that my question dealt with my own comfort level, and what I found out very quickly is how much we have in common sitting around that table on the first session that we join.
And that's in diving into my own WWW experience, I will say that I joined also a good 6 or 7 months after my husband passed away, and they said they had to get a group together. And so there were several months in between my request and their calling me. But when we met on Zoom, I remember that. We met on Zoom. I was out in L.A., and we had 2 or 3 meetings on Zoom. And then when we all met together in person, we felt like sisters under the skin. We were all hugging each other, some with masks on, some without. But it was such a warm feeling to be with the women that I'd cried over Zoom so many times. And I remember my son asking me, well, Mom, what is it, the best thing about the group? And I didn't even have to even think. I said, I can say anything in there that I want to say, and everybody understands. Right. You're not, you know, given that funny look like you get from your kids or Mom, get over it kind of thing. So what do you find? I know I have had many challenges as a widow, but what do you see as some of the biggest challenges that widows face in your groups? Patty?
Well, there are many, as you know. I love what you said about sisters under the skin, because I think that is exactly what emerges pretty quickly in the groups and makes it really so, in some ways, so pleasant for us as facilitators to see the group come together so quickly. The obstacles are legion. I often think about it as waking up in a world that you've never been to before, where you don't speak the language, you don't know the rules, the culture is different, and it's dark.
That sounds about right.
And within that world, you have financial obstacles, you have social obstacles, you have emotional obstacles, you have the culture that we live in, which is a very coupled culture. So learning to be alone constantly is, it's an enormous adjustment. And I think people who are widowed understand that almost immediately. And it's one of the things that binds people together so quickly, mm-hmm. that we all speak the same language. You don't have to explain why it was hard coming home that night to an empty house.
Right.
You don't have to explain why it's hard to eat dinner alone. You don't have to explain why you don't feel like calling anybody. Because everybody understands immediately. And so there's this sense of, with all the obstacles, that we are definitely in this together and that you're not alone. I think that the sense of being alone when you're widowed, whether it's a sudden loss or a loss that's taken several years to really happen, you finally don't feel alone with it. There are other people who have had maybe not the same experience, but similar losses. And very often, I was thinking about this, in our groups at NCJW, we tend to see people who've been in fairly long-term marriages, not all the time, but people who've been in a coupled relationship almost all their adult lives. And so it makes it even harder,
right,
to become single again.
I know that was certainly the case in our group. We all were in, mm-hmm. and in fact, one of my questions was, I don't know if it was by chance or by design, but the women in my group were all pretty close in age, and all the husbands had died within maybe 6 months of each other. And I wondered, well, now you're saying you don't necessarily put them together by age. They can be very diverse. But
right.
mine was, our group anyway, was pretty similar.
I think the main criteria is what you just said, though, is waiting for about 6 months after somebody's passed away. It's usually we recommend people between 3 and 6 months. Because the first year, as I'm sure you remember this, maybe you don't.
Oh, yes, I do. Unfortunately.
Is you feel like you're in a fog.
Yeah.
And so if you start to try to sort through all these complicated feelings when you're still in a really thick fog, it's really hard to do. And especially the first 3 months where you're just pretty crushed by the grief often. All these decisions that have to be made, and financial decisions and credit card decisions, all this stuff. And it's very hard to sort through all that when you have sort of this heaviness on your shoulders all the time. So after about 6 months, we have just found that people are able to get a little bit of space to start to talk about the experience more and what it's beginning to mean to them in many different ways. So,
mm-hmm. I often think, Nancy, that for me, that three-month period was driven, intense, just high adrenaline, and it kept me going. And I didn't have time to think about other things because I had to take care of things I'd never had to take care of before.
Right.
So I think once the adrenaline settles, then for me, I was able to feel differently, you know, contribute, recognize what was going on with me, have the inclination to discuss how I was feeling. But I think, you know, as Patty talks about the fogginess of that.
It's so true.
Yeah, for me it was almost like nonstop, don't stop. Don't stop to feel, don't stop to talk about it. Just keep on going, because otherwise, I don't know what might happen otherwise.
I know I flew out to California with my daughter, and I did a lot of, like, flying back and forth, and I moved out of my house, and I did all the things you're not supposed to do, but my kids were so worried about me. They were just kind of supporting me, holding me up. As I've heard said, you know, the first year you just try to stand up. I think just getting out of bed was a big feat for me. So you're right, and I think the hardest thing is that, and that's what was so beautiful about joining this group. I would talk to my friends, and they would say, oh, I'm so sorry, and they would try to listen. But if they hadn't lost a spouse, you realize they didn't really understand the depth of the loneliness and closing that door by yourself.
Mm-hmm. And that's where those questions come in that don't do you any good.
Oh, my favorite list.
Are you going to sell your house? Are you going to get a dog?
Are you going to travel?
Right.
Are you going to date?
Yeah.
I think it's mostly people don't know what to say.
Right.
You know, generally after a death, people are surrounded by their friends for a while. People bring food. People call. But fairly quickly, people return to their own lives, their own issues, their own difficulties. And you really are left not completely alone, but pretty alone. And people find it very hard to talk about how you really are because it's so upsetting to people.
Yes.
You know, people want you to be better. People want you to get going.
Yeah. Well, even my dearest friend, when I was out in California, I said, I just feel like everybody's ignoring me, like I'm invisible. And she said, well, Nancy, you're an actress. You need to put a smile on your face. And I thought, no, I'm in touch with my feelings. And if I feel like crying, I'm going to cry. I just, not that I cried to everybody that I talked to, but if I wasn't walking around like Pollyanna, right. Too bad. Right. And she said, no, you've got to hold it in and you've got to act and you've got to. And for me, that didn't work.
Right.
I thought it was better to let out my feelings with whom I could. And that's what was so great about this group.
Yeah.
And I noticed in the first meeting when you went around and had everyone say who they were and talk about their husbands and their experiences, and we all seem to have perfect husbands. That's the other thing. I guess people don't join these groups if they're not madly in love with their husbands, right?
All husbands are perfect, Nancy.
I think, though, as people get to know each other better, they start to share more of the reality of the relationships. You know, every relationship has issues, conflicts.
Really? Mine didn't.
but I think you're right, though. I think when people die, they become angels very quickly, and then it takes a while for us to allow them to be human beings
right.
again.
That's right.
Right.
But I'm curious because the first meeting went so well, and I think of the first meeting as the one where we were in person because the rest I can't remember because I was in such a fog. But do you have a format that you follow, or do you follow your own intuition?
I want to backtrack for a second because it's such a great question. When we go around the first session and we ask people to introduce themselves, we don't ask them to tell us how their husbands died. We ask them to tell us about themselves. And in every group that we've done, every woman introduces herself by the death of her husband.
Interesting.
Which
I
think is really interesting.
Curious,
well,
right.
Because I think that's, they come.
That defines them.
In that moment, that's how they feel defined, that they have lost their husbands. And what is that going to mean to them?
And that label of widow creates a whole new identity that nobody quite knows how to manage.
Right. Yeah. And I realized why there aren't so many programs, as Carolyn Moore talks about in her interview, that there's no line item for widows in the government. There's no line item for, and it's because they're mainly men that have been running all these things, and they don't want to talk about widows because what does widow mean? It means they're gone. So it's like their own mortality is at stake, right? So it's difficult for them to bring up that
but
word.
But we don't have a form. We don't. Well, the format, if you will, that Peggy and I have developed, it was really Peggy's idea. Why don't you introduce?
Well, I think
that?
There are a couple of things. Just to build on what Patty said about how those introductions are so important. That's the trust-building part. You know, if I can sit around this table and not just introduce myself, but tell you some of the most intimate details of my life, oh, my God, I'm trusting others who are at the table. And you know over time more comes out.
Right.
So I think one of the reasons the program is so successful is that the agenda for each session is set by whoever's at the table. So how do you get there? Patty and I began to do what we call check-ins, which a lot of groups are using these days, to take a few minutes to tell us how your week went. What's on your mind today? What's bugging you? What would you like to talk about? What do you bring to the group? And one of us will lead that conversation. And it's not necessarily going around the table because person C may build on person A, and then person G jumps in. And so there's so much fluidity, and it's creating, you know, just glue that holds the group together for that evening. So if I'm doing the making sure everybody has a minute or two to check in, Patty's taking notes. And she's extraordinary at finding the themes and knowing what fits, what builds on the last time we were together, what might move us a little bit further. So that's how those agendas get set.
You did a beautiful job with it, I will say.
Thank you. But we listen for themes, and usually there are two or three things that really are sort of striking. And sometimes there's somebody who clearly has something very specific that they're very upset about that they really need space to talk about. And we add that in, of course. I mean, we try to be as responsive as we possibly can. And that's why we try to keep the group between, you know what, 8 to 12 people, 12 max, so that people do have a chance to really express themselves.
And the time is 90 minutes, correct?
90 minutes each which session. Is not very much, right?
Yeah, no, so, I always felt like we could have gone longer.
Oh, yeah.
Which was my next point. I'm sure there's always somebody who talks more than others, usually me, and sometimes people who don't want to talk maybe or they're reticent. How do you equalize the voices in the room? Or does it just happen naturally? No? So what do you do about that? You say, okay, Nancy, that's enough. You've already been talking 10 minutes.
No, you know what? We've had group members who really say almost nothing. And I sometimes will ask them, would you like me to ask you to participate or would you like to just listen? And we'll have a little sort of off the record conversation. And there are people who get so much out of just being there and listening and feeling and learning from other people, but feel like they're just not ready to talk very much or they're not used to talking in a group. It doesn't happen very often. Usually almost everybody participates pretty equally, I would think. But there are people whose grief is such that they just really need to cry most of the session. And will say very little, but they are listening to everything and making a connection with people. And may go out to dinner with people afterwards and be much more relaxed and talking. So we try to be sensitive to that. I will certainly keep my eye out, and Peggy does too, to see if there's somebody whose eyebrows go up or who has some sort of reaction to something that's being said. And I might say, Janie, looks like you had something to add to what Nancy just said. And so that sort of flows normally and sort of naturally. But it's a conversation. So just as you would at in any group, you're sensitive to who's talking and who's not, and is there a way to engage them? Is it better not to? Some of it's intuition, experience.
With check-ins, I think we do some boundary setting, we really mean take a minute because that could go on much longer than we'd like. What starts to happen, Nancy, you probably remember, is people start helping one another.
Yeah.
Jumping in with suggestions, jumping in with, have you tried this? Or I felt that too. And so it's a judgment call at times when we pull the reins in, and say, let's come back to that in a little bit. That's really a good topic.
Right.
Or whether it makes sense to go with it at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But these are mature, respectful people.
Right. It was funny because I went to a counselor before I went to your group, in individual sessions. Mm-hmm. And I remember my son saying, they were 50-minute sessions or 55-minute sessions. He said, okay, so, Mom, who talks more, you or her? And I said, oh, I give her 5 minutes at the end. Because it was basically my just walking in and just bursting out crying. I was in that stage where that's all I could do was cry. And I was glad I went through that before joining this group. Not that I still didn't cry with the group, but you're right. You get rid of some of that initial horrible, traumatic...
One of the things I've learned from Patty is to let the tears flow. Mm-hmm. There's a reason they're coming up.
Yeah. That was a beautiful thing that the rabbi said at Ted's funeral. She said, tears have to come out. You know, they're made to come out. They're not meant to stay inside. And I love that.
Me too. My father-in-law was a Presbyterian minister, and he would say, never pass up the opportunity for a good cry.
Oh, I love that.
Which I always thought was so wise.
My husband always said, oh, Nancy will cry just looking at a wall.
Yeah. But to that point, quite seriously, I think the tears often have to come first before you can start to put words to the feelings. And so we're respectful of that. There's a lot of, as you know, there are a lot of tears in the meetings.
Right.
And there's also a lot of laughter.
A lot of laughter, yes.
Yeah.
And Patty, since you've worked with people with, who I don't know, have cancer or have passed away with cancer and other support groups, do you find that a widow's grief is different from other types of grief?
Such a good question. Intuitively, I would say not really. Some of the issues are certainly different. I mean, learning to live alone in a coupled world, taking on all the responsibilities for finances and major life decisions. And yes, of course, that's really different from maybe losing an elderly parent or something that felt more in the natural course of things. I think it's different, but grief itself, I think, is highly personal and individualized for people. It's something that people will gradually learn to live with and gradually soften around. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, I always resent, I really don't like expressions like work through your grief, things like that, as if there's an end, as if it's a beginning and end, as if it's a linear process.
Right.
Grieving is not a linear process. It's very circular, I think, and it goes on in different ways for many, many years, maybe the rest of our lives. But it's in different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, something will spark a memory, or there'll be
the triggers,
an anniversary or a birthday.
Or a song.
Mm. It can be anything. And that it's so highly individualistic, you know.
One of the things, I don't know if this fits in here quite exactly, but you asked how grieving the loss of a partner differs from other kinds of grief. I mean, the cliche of I know just how you feel leads to me wanting to strangle someone who has not had the same experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think the world's learning. That's not the appropriate thing to say.
I had a sister that passed away when I was 8 years old, and she was 9. Mm. And my father, I mean, I can still feel it to this day, so I know when a child does understand death, because I did at age 8. My father, there were 4 of us at the time, and people came up to me and said, well, at least you've got all these other children. And my dad, I remember him saying, what does he think? They're all kittens? They're just drowned kittens. You drown a kitten and you don't miss the kitten? You know, and I'd see my father cry, and that was the hardest. My mother was just wiped out. You know, she couldn't even cry. But it made me more empathetic for the rest of my life because of having that feeling. But when people would say that to my dad, and of course, you have to not fault them because they think they're being helpful.
Right.
It's very hard unless you know. Sometimes the best thing is just to give the person a hug and not say a word, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm trying to think of how I might have reacted when I heard the questions or heard the comments that, you know, would send me in the opposite direction. We talk about this in the group, like, people say, how are you doing? How do you feel? Like, as if they want us to say, oh, we're great. It's terrific.
Yeah.
Things are just fine. You know? And I think the best, one of the better responses is I'm managing. It's not easy. I'm managing.
This is not going to get over it so fast. This is one of the things that I love about the groups, that the women really share with each other their wisdom about how to handle some of these very provocative, sometimes unexpected experiences.
So one of the things I really disliked, well, it took me a while to understand it. People saying, let's have lunch, you know, and I would defer. I'm not ready to go out for lunch. But I've never been ready to go out to lunch. I eat my yogurt on top of my keyboard. I don't do lunch.
Right.
But it took me a while to connect with that, and I vividly remember, and you'll relate to this, being in the restroom at Temple and thinking to myself, I get it. I know why I don't want to go out for lunch. And so the next time someone asked, oh, let's do lunch, you know, I said, really, I value my daytime. I don't want to leave home. I've got too much to do in the day. But dinner time is when I'm alone, and that, dinner invitations I would welcome.
It's so funny you said that, because that's been my biggest problem. People will say, oh, let's do lunch, and I'm thinking, what about dinner? That's when I'm lonely,
yeah,
right? I wasn't with
so
my husband
to
during the day.
You've got to practice and develop your assertive skills, for
right.
God's sake, along with everything
dinner?
Else you're doing.
Yeah, right. And I don't mind going with you and your husband. You know, and most of the time, I know their husbands well, and I don't mind going. Right. And I don't know if they don't want to share their husbands with me or what it is, but they always say, lunch. You're right.
I think it's one of those really hard adjustments that widows get left out of social gatherings. In St. Louis, I can't speak to
no, I think it's everywhere.
World.
I think it is everywhere.
But and it's painful. You know, people go out as couples. If somebody has a dinner party, they tend not to invite a single person. And it is painful. And even people who are really close to you think in terms of couples. I think it's
yes.
It's,
no,
it's
it is
just
a couple's
the world,
world
that we live in.
There's so much to learn from that. I remember being with a group of four, so there were two widows and a couple. And the other woman placed her order with the server and said, I'd like my own bill. I'd like my own check, please. And I was like, oh, that's how you do it. I ask for my own check. It was like liberation. Okay, now I can say I will go out for dinner with a couple, you know, and know that I'm paying my way. Today, when you go out with a group, post-COVID, everybody's offering individual checks. It's mm-hmm. not a big deal. But pre-COVID, it was a big deal in some mm-hmm. places. Mm-hmm. We can't divide mm-hmm. up the check. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just saying.
Yeah. No, I was used to my husband picking up the check wherever we went.
Right.
And suddenly, you go out with somebody and you're like, okay, do I offer to pay for my share or... You know, if they've invited me out, are they picking it up? And it is awkward because these are little things, but the things that he always took care of that I never had to even think about.
Right.
And it's
right.
just another thing about being a single woman. And when you've been married as long as we all have, mm-hmm. it's a big change.
It's a huge and change.
Couple Tim, is quite
well, we,
an
we've joked in the group that I'll see couples walking down the street and I just want to go by them and like trip them, you know, because no, I'm so jealous of the two of them walking together.
Can't so you're just, at that stage of grief.
Yeah, I'm at that stage, yes. Well, I went to church the other day and there was this couple my age or older, like three or four rows in front of me. And my husband never went to church with me anyway because he was Jewish and I'm mm-hmm. Catholic, although we shared our faiths. I shared his more than he shared mine. Mm-hmm. And so I'd go to church alone. Well, now that he's gone, this couple were holding hands and then at the sign of peace, they hugged. And I just looked at them and just was so jealous. I mean, the feeling of right. jealousy was so deep
right.
that, you know, and formerly I would have thought, oh, isn't that sweet?
Right.
Whereas now I'm just like, oh, my
well,
gosh.
Well, it's what you were talking about before, the triggers.
Yes.
That you don't expect that to happen, and yet it happens. And,
right.
Yeah, and you have this ache for, gee, I really miss that
yes.
so much.
And my
miss
husband,
him.
I just said this to my son 2 days ago. My husband was the master at surprises. Emily knows, my assistant. He couldn't give a party without it being a surprise. If you knew about it, you had to pretend that you were surprised because it would kill him if you didn't, you know, act surprised. Everything was a surprise with him. Surprise fireworks at our daughter's wedding in Italy and you know, everything. So I said to my son, maybe Dad is going to surprise me and just pop up somewhere. This whole thing. He goes, I don't think so, Mom. And of course, I don't believe it either. Mm. But part of me at this point, 2 years later, still has trouble believing that it's really happened.
Okay, what's the book?
Okay, I need a book, right? So I need a book to set me straight.
What's the book? The Year of
the Year Magical Thinking.
I started reading that right after he died, and it was too raw.
It's too early.
But now I could maybe read it.
But it would make more sense.
But yes. I think that sense of disbelief, I still can feel that 8 years later. It's like, how did that happen to him? I can remember very vividly the first year or two, you know, just really feeling that so strongly. How did that happen? I don't believe that happened. I can't. And you find yourself saying,
I can't believe it. Right.
I can't believe that happened. And I think that's a very normal response to something that's very overwhelming and traumatic. I can't believe it. It's like we push it away.
Right. And there's a real PTSD after it happens, mm-hmm. I think. Don't you think mm-hmm. that you keep reliving it in your mind?
You mm-hmm. pass a, mm-hmm. you walk through some space in your home. Something comes in the mail. There are just so many reminders.
Yeah.
Or so many situations. Well, I think something that we haven't said here yet, but it comes up in every group. This...
if only I had done this?
This cry for the husband. You know, like, so... You're like, where are you, Ted? I need you now.
Right?
I mean, there's that shared understanding that, okay, the dishwasher broke or... The garage door won't go up, and
well, he couldn't.
Who do I share this with?
He couldn't help the dishwasher. I used to tease him. He flew an airplane, and I'd ask him to load the dishwasher. He goes, "I don't know how to run a dishwasher." I said, "You can fly an airplane, and you cannot figure out the dishwasher."
I think one of the hardest things, segue on what Peggy just said, is making decisions.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Who do you make them with now?
Exactly.
It's really hard. It's major life decisions. There's this sense of confusion, like, do I really want to do that? Is that the right thing to do? Who do I talk to about this? And again, the group can be helpful to the extent that people are coming to the group for that short period of time.
Right.
It's only for 3 months, 3 or 4 months. But I think it's something that's really hard for people.
Yes.
In an ongoing way, any major life decision.
Like a good friend of mine said, you know, I wanted to buy a new car and I didn't have my husband to talk to. Mm-hmm. What do I get?
You know, weighing options.
And
doing the homework.
I am very blessed, and my son, if you're listening, I have a son who's an attorney who has taken care of every bit of every, you know, legal paperwork and et cetera. But it's funny. I will call him about something that I'm confused about, and I'll say, you know, I'm really upset about that house. I don't think I'm going to get that house. He goes, well, Mom, that's fine. Then don't get it. And then he hangs up the phone. And my husband would have sat and listened to me vacillate back and forth mm-hmm. because he, not that my son doesn't love me, but there's a different relationship you have with your husband where he was so good at just sitting, listening to me grumble about things because he knew that was me. Whereas a child is like, okay, I want a black or white answer. I'm helping you, Mom. I gave you my answer. Make up your mind. Do you understand the difference?
I do.
It's hard.
I think it speaks so much to the friendships that form over time in these groups.
Yes.
Because we do want someone to be available to listen to the pros and cons as we talk them out, as we weigh decisions. And for in my group, I have found that there are women upon whom I can call. Say I'm
still
about to make
day.
It still mm-hmm. to this day.
Mm-hmm. I too.
You know, it might just be what do I wear to this party tonight, mm-hmm. but it might be I found a couple of things, you know, from your recent video doorbells. Who do I talk to about video doorbells?
Right. Patty's your answer. No, you're absolutely right.
But so that's the friendships that develop mm-hmm. as a result of these groups are enduring for many, many groups.
Yeah.
And there is nothing like these bonds that develop
yes.
over time that stay with us, that take some effort. But one of the things that we do before a group completes is to say, please come up with a time when you know you're going to see one another again.
Yes, and we did do that. We were so glad you suggested that.
And well, I think this really speaks to something that, Nancy, that you used the word invisible a little while ago.
Yes.
I think women, when they become widows, do feel invisible. The world treats them like they're invisible often. And these kinds of connections, of course, help to cut through that feeling. One of the things that really struck me, I don't know if you were able to come to the big celebration
last
year.
No, I wasn't. I'm so
sorry. The 47th year?
Yeah.
Celebration of the program. And there were 150, 200 widows together in a big hall. And it was such, somebody said to me, oh, we're not invisible.
Oh,
wow.
You know, but I think what happens to many, many people is that you do start to feel invisible socially, sometimes economically. Your financial situation changes. Your living situation often changes. And you really feel so like you're on an island by yourself. And this sense of invisibility, I think, is really one of the key reasons why the program is successful, to help people not feel invisible anymore, feel seen. You know, somebody says it's so good to see you, and you think it's so good to be seen again.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. My daughter, I have a daughter in Chicago who's been wonderful. I don't think she's missed a day calling me since my husband's passed away. And everyone's supposed to call and say, I'm with one of my wife widow women friends. We're having dinner. And she's like, oh, Mom, enjoy yourself. You know, she's so happy because she knows I'm with someone that's connecting. And my daughter and I connect beautifully, but this woman can connect even better with the feelings I'm going
through. That's lovely. I'm so glad to hear that. That's wonderful.
Yes, it has been wonderful. And some of the problems, of course, I've experienced is coming home, we've all talked about this, to an empty house and someone to have dinner with. But the other thing is that my husband was, the other thing he was, he had these great corny jokes, and he was always making me laugh. And they say laughter is the best medicine. And I've really found that I've been lacking humor in my life since he's passed away. And I'm kind of going in search of it. And I find that my grandchildren are able to make me laugh more than anything. But when I'm not with them, and I certainly don't want to hover and be there every night for dinner. Do you have any other suggestions besides watching comedians on TV or trying to find funny books or just looking up funny people? Or do I reach out on Instagram? Hey there, I want to talk to you if you're funny. You know, can contact me.
Only funny people need apply.
Right, you know, only funny people.
It's a great question, Nancy. I don't have an easy answer for that. I think people miss different parts of the relationships they had with their husbands. And you all had a very humorous relationship and a husband who apparently was a very funny person and could tell funny stories and make you laugh.
Well, mainly he was making fun of me. But where my kids would get disgusted with me, he would laugh at the things I did.
And for other people, it's something else that they really miss in the relationship. So how do you fill that? How do you fill that void that's left? You know, and it could be anything. It could be the humor. It could be sitting down and having a glass of wine together at the end of a long day. It's the sharing of how your day was or how your week was. Or
curling up with Netflix.
Yeah, well, I curl. Movie. That's become my husband, Netflix.
Yeah. and the intimacy that you had as a spouse, you know, the sexual intimacy. So there's so many things that we miss. And so how do we fill that? How do we even begin to compensate? Because we can't fill the void. People try, but you can't fill something like that. You can compensate for it in certain ways.
Right.
You can find pleasure elsewhere. I read something the other day which really touched me. It was an essay written by a woman who had lost a child. And somebody said to her, how are you doing? And she said, you know, I felt like saying, I feel terrible all the time, and I have a good day here and there.
Which was the truth, I'm
Which
sure.
Which is the truth. But I'm sure there are things that make you laugh.
Oh, absolutely.
You still have your sense of humor. You still have your vibrancy. You still have the way you engage with people. You're still a very colorful woman.
Oh, thank you.
But what you miss is what he brought to the relationship and how that worked for the two of you.
Right.
I think there's so much that we do
I think there are changes that we make over time after losing our partners.
Right.
Maybe I become a little bit more like the man I loved. Maybe I develop in a different direction. Maybe I develop a sense of humor. But I think one of the big things I've learned is it's up to me, and it's my responsibility.
Right.
No one's gonna do it for me, do it to me. And
one of the things I've done is share my grief in a way with, like, my granddaughter in LA is 8, and she loves to sleep with me when she's, in fact, she's gotten in trouble by her mother and gotten grounded because we make so much noise talking. It's past her bedtime, et cetera. I said, it's not her fault, it's my fault. But I did something. I started the night that my husband died. Well, I had been writing a gratitude journal. And that very night, I wrote about him, and I haven't missed a night since he's passed away.
Oh.
So when I was writing to him, and she was sitting next to me, she said, Nana, what are you writing? And I said, I'm writing to Papa. And she said, can I write to him? And then she wrote down,
oh, how sweet.
Papa, I'm having trouble at school. And she asked Papa to help her, you know, with that. And so when we went to sleep that night, I reached out for her hand, and I said, Dagny, would you please put your hand in mine? And she put her little hand in mine. And he just, of course, worshiped the ground, and all his grandchildren walked on. And I said, oh, this is so wonderful for me because Papa's blood is flowing through your body. And every night, Papa held my hand. And with your little hand in mine, I have a piece of Papa that I'm holding on to. And it makes me feel so good. And then she said, well, Nana, I'm sorry to say this, but it would be pretty creepy if you were holding hands with a dead man. and that was the joy also of the spontaneity of a child.
Right.
That when she said that, I burst out laughing. And we had the gentleness of the touch of her little hand in mine and then the laughter of a child. And
the honesty.
And the honesty. But they keep his spirit alive.
Right. I was going to say, and he was
yes,
in that sense.
They were just in Hawaii Memorial Day weekend. And my daughter texted me.
Sweet.
She said, Mom, we just saw a monarch butterfly. And then suddenly what landed in Hawaii was a cardinal. And they said, it's Papa. And they're keeping his memory alive, even though they were only 4 and 6 when he passed away. They very much remember him. But, of course, that helps me talking about him, and they love it, too.
Right.
And that's where I find my joy the most, I think, is in my grandchildren and knowing they're all a part of him. Mm-hmm. And I see little pieces of him in all of them, which is really joyful.
That's wonderful.
I think we have so much to teach them because those innocents are going to be asking the hard questions that other people don't, the honest questions. And the more we can answer them honestly rather than push them aside, that's culture changing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And another little story I have to share about my other granddaughter here in St. Louis. We took her, I guess it was maybe 6 months after my husband died. We took her, my son and I, to the mausoleum. And she came into the mausoleum and she said, her nanny had someone that had passed away, and she said, her family is here too. And we said, well, no, they're not here. They're somewhere else. They're not in the cemetery. They're in another country. And she kind of looked, and I said, look, here's her little cousin had drawn a picture of her pop. And she said, she's been here too? And she looked shocked. And then we ran around the cemetery. I didn't think much about it. Well, she went home to her mother, to my daughter-in-law. My daughter-in-law told me that she ran in the door and she said, Mama, I went to heaven to see Papa and I didn't even die.
Oh, sweet.
And she thought the mausoleum was heaven.
Oh, yeah. How sweet.
And it's like at that age of 3,
everything
is what they see in their mind is their reality.
Sure.
But all those things are so uplifting. Sweet comments.
So you have found
so
other things
that
it's different from Ted's humor. Right.
Right.
But it's uplifting.
Right. Absolutely.
And it's joyful.
Absolutely.
And it makes you smile.
As facilitators, the two of you have worked so well together. Any final thoughts that you want to add, like how this has been for you all these years and what it's done for you as a person to help so many women?
You know, each time a group starts, I relive my own story, my own grief.
And is that hard for you or does it help?
I don't know how to answer that. I don't know how to answer that. I know what it does is it gives me access to intimacy with a group of strangers who I will know much better in 12 weeks. And that's worth so much, because this work that we do is so important. So the opportunities that folks have sitting around this table for 12 sessions, we know now, and we know is unique, and we know it's very healing. And so for me, it probably is healing, and I love. Love is a funny word to use here, but I know that I can bring my own experiences to the table to say, I get it. I know where you've been. This was my experience. And every now and then there's a comment that's made that brings back something for me that I've never put words to. It's an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, in mentoring, hasn't it been said that in mentoring, especially in something like grief, that you will eventually come full circle when you help others heal, that will help you heal because you're helping them heal? No, Patty?
No, I think there are people who would describe that experience in that way, absolutely. I think, I love your question. I think, what's it like for us? I think for me, very personally, it's very connecting. I guess I was always a very serious child, and I always liked connecting people in truth, and became a therapist when I was a young woman. I was in practice for 50 years, working with families.
You're in kindergarten, right?
Working with individuals and families, working with a lot of cancer patients, a lot of very sick people. And I had a real affinity for working with people in a very intimate way. And I think having lost my partner, my work became even more important in a way. And really being able to connect with women whose experiences I have actually shared is for me very personally, it's a very nice way of not feeling invisible, of feeling like, you know, we have a place in this culture, and we have work to do to help each other feel not whole. I hate words like that, but feel what's the right word?
It's like a path of healing.
Yeah. I mean, to feel sort of like they have meaning, mm-hmm. and that their lives have meaning, and that they will be able to craft a new way of being in the world, and that we're all in this together. It's a very connecting experience.
Well, it's been a beautiful experience for me. Yeah. Patty Krogan and Peggy Cohen-Voss, I want to thank you for all that you've done for me through this Wife, Widow, Woman program. And please tell our listeners again how they can reach out to Wife, Widow, Woman.
I would be glad to do that. One can easily find the National Council of Jewish Women online, ncjwstl.org, or call Renee Siegel-Hurst at 314-993-5181. Renee is Director of Community Impact for NCJW. So calls will get filtered to her as groups are formed.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again so much for your time and your talent and your patience and compassion for me and for all the women in my group and all the many women that have learned and grown from grief through growth in your group. Thank you so much for being on Woman Overboard. I'm so grateful for my time today with Patty Krogan and Peggy Cohen-Voss, the leaders of my Wife, Widow, Woman grief support group after I lost my husband, Ted. Through the National Council of Jewish Women, their work has helped thousands of St. Louis widows grow through their grief to a renewed life.